We present For One Horrible Moment by Peter Bradshaw. Episode 3. Degradation.
Previously on For One Horrible Moment. As a young boy growing up in the Fens, I have developed a sexual fascination with an older girl called Susan, for which my father has threatened me with severe punishment. She bears a close resemblance to me, and the shiver of erotic mystery that I have derived from my new friend is compounded when I see her in a hitherto unknown family photograph. On the last day of school before we broke up, my brother Edward and I would file into Papa's panelled library after morning prayers, during which he performed a lengthy liturgical dance entitled The Conversion of Zion. It was then time for our sexual relations lesson. "Boys," he says, "the sexual act must always be committed within a context of loving commitment. Autoerotic acts like hanging or self-mutilation are not acceptable in a family environment, difficult though that is for some urban sophisticates to believe." Here he fixes me with a terrible gaze. "Think of your private parts as a telephone. Like the telephone, they do not belong to you, but are leased from a higher power. Like the telephone, they should be handled as sparingly as possible. Like the telephone, they can, in the wrong hands, be the means for illicit gratification when no one else is in the house. They must be pleasing in the eyes of our Maker. The sexual act is a sacrament, and the purpose of that sacrament is the procreation of children." The lesson was over. Edward reached across the desk to embrace Papa. It was warmly reciprocated. I shyly attempted the same thing, but Papa drew back and sternly placed on the desk between us a plastic Next Customer Please division bar that he had borrowed from the checkout at Budgeon in Ely. It was his method of choice for indicating his coldness and alienation from me. As we file out and down the back stairs into the bathroom, where Gretchen, our 16-year-old au pair, is waiting to give us our bath, I take Ed aside and motion him into the unoccupied billiard room. "Ed," I say urgently, "do you know Mrs. Hennessy?" "I haven't had her, if that's what you mean," says Ed. "No, no, I mean, do you know her?"
"Shag her, do you mean?"
"Ed, don't be a silly," I say impatiently. "Mrs. Hennessy told me she knew something about Susan, the girl I saw at church." Suddenly, Edward becomes very silent and walks thoughtfully over to the bookshelf, pulling out a copy of Thomas Carlyle's Sartor Resartus and perfunctorily turning over its uncut pages. Finally, he looks up and speaks.
"You know, you shouldn't speak about that, old boy. Papa wouldn't like it." He pauses.
"Mrs. Hennessy lives in a houseboat on the river. She's a bit sad." Gretchen appears in the billiard room at that moment, wearing a bath towel and carrying a 3-foot loofah, one of the giant sort farmed in the Philippines. As they leave together for the bathroom, I slip out into the garden. Instinctively, I call for the only friend I have left in the world.
"Jeff! Jeff Moose! Jeff! Jeffer! Jeff!"
Instantly, the old dog appears in obedience to my call. As he gambols about my feet, I can see from the set of his ears that he wishes me to follow him. Jiff Moose scampers out of the garden and then returns, looking at me imploringly. He scampers off and then scampers back. Then he raises his paw and makes a curious beckoning movement. "What is it, boy?" I ask. "Do you want me to follow you?" Jiff rolls his eyes in exasperation and leads me out of the garden's side gate and down through the winding lanes that surround Papa's estate, over a stile, and into some woodland. He breaks into a gallop, and I follow suit. Soon we are chasing madly, the brambles and branches lashing at my face as I gasp to keep up with him. Suddenly, he bolts through a thicket into open country. There is a muffled yelp, and I see that Jiff is holding, between his jaws, Henry, my lop-eared Angoran rabbit, who must have slipped out of his hutch. My delight in seeing him is tempered by the fact that Jiff has brutally severed Henry's jugular vein. Content with his prey, Jif Moose scampers back into the woods, the limp furry carcass between his teeth, leaving me in what is evidently low and marshy ground. I am in fact by the river's edge, where I can see a small houseboat moored. Mrs. Hennessy is on deck, wearing a jaunty peaked nautical cap and denim dungarees. Young and naive as I am, I can tell that the ensemble effect is stunningly unattractive. She motions me aboard. "Do you know how your father and I first met?" Mrs. Hennessy asks casually. I shake my head vigorously, causing the boat to pitch and heave slightly. "Well, I was the consultant psychotherapist at Fulbourn Hospital. When you were 10 years old, your father brought you to see me because of your frankly disgusting bedwetting problem." I cough uneasily. "A problem which I understand continues to this day." At this point, Mrs. Hennessy produces her issue of the photocopied quarterly newsletter devoted to this topic that my father distributes locally, complete with news, views, cartoons, and a crossword. I remain silent. "I put you in a light hypnotic trance and asked you to recount your earliest memory. I had the foresight to commit the results to audio tape. Would you like to hear them now?" Dumbfounded, I can only nod. Mrs. Hennessy leans across to a large tape spool machine and presses the play button. This is what I hear.
"I remember Papa shouting that Nobby Stiles was an irresponsible bastard who almost lost it for us by chopping down the West German striker in the 89th minute, so conceding the free kick that gave the equaliser to Wolfgang Weber. He was shouting about how the controversial goal in extra time was needless, and Edward and me were both really scared, and he was shouting that Nobby Stiles was a gap-toothed git who ought to be shot. Then he started shouting at Susan and made us leave the room."
Susan. So I did have a sister called Susan, or a cousin, or a family friend. Mrs. Hennessy would only say that I was suppressing some family trauma, and that the case was so upsetting for her that she left hypnotherapy and took up selling pork-related hot snacks from a hatch in the side of her houseboat, together with her own brand still cola. She could not or would not say why Susan had left, and why my father refused to acknowledge her existence. The houseboat begins to roll with the heavy swell of the river, and soon the cramped craft becomes extensively perfumed by the chemical toilet. "You must find Susan," she tells me. "You must resolve all your unspoken rage and hurt. Let the healing begin." I hastily leave the craft, which is called the Loving Kebab. Mrs. Hennessy unmoors the boat, cranks up her outboard engine, and roars off upriver into the heart of an immense darkness. "Silly cow," says a voice behind me. I turn around to see Susan, precociously at the wheel of a Ford Anglia, decorated with an enormous psychedelic starburst image of Robert Carr, the then Home Secretary, entwined with Bunty from the children's television programme How. Susan's face is obscured by a large pair of pink-rimmed sunglasses and heavy makeup. Nonchalantly, she flicks out of the window the ash from her cigarette, a tipped cadet, and returns it to her exquisite mouth with metallic grey lipstick that I can almost taste. With her in the passenger seat is her brother, his lank, blonde hair almost concealing his long, gaunt face as he peruses his copy of the comic Score and Roar. "Hop in," she says, gesturing at the back seat. She watches me with her characteristic enigmatic smile, as for some minutes I search the entire back half of the strange pointy car to find the back door. There isn't one. With a tiny silvery laugh, she prevails upon her brother, whose name is Olaf, to open his passenger door and get out to let me in. "Where are we going?" I ask, and then, "How are you allowed to drive a car?" Susan merely shrugs. There was silence after that, and I looked out at the endlessly level countryside, a land where, as my father put it, a man might go melancholy mad. Soon we reached a secluded copse with a tiny pool. We sit down in the grass and watch, as at the water's edge, Olaf threw stones at some shivering, wretched ducks. Susan makes to kiss me, but I pull away, confused, upset, and somehow chuffed all at the same time. "What happened in the churchyard?" I finally ask. "Nothing," she says insouciantly, pulling out another tipped cadet. "We talked for a while about pop music and homework. It was sweet." "So, nothing happened?" I ask. "No," she smiles. There is a terrible cry of duck pain from the pond, together with a shout of obscene triumph from Olaf. Then silence again. In later life, I have brought each of my three wives, now ex-wives, down to this secluded spot to try to recapture the strange, languorous passion I experienced as a 12-year-old with my new friend Susan. On each occasion, my wife has left in tears, and one even used it as grounds for divorce in itself. A slight breeze mitigates the hot sun out in that exposed countryside, which I sense will soon bring out my habitual sunburn. I ask Susan if she is my sister, and she smiles and says no. "My cousin?" I ask, and again she says no, but I sense that there is something she is not telling me. "But why were you on holiday with us in Hunstanton?" Susan says she was a sort of live-in nanny or au pair. "But how can that be?" I ask, my soul as turbulent and disturbed as the surface of the pool into which Olaf has waded, growling, up to his knees. "You can only have been 13 or 14. She does not reply, but only says, "Your father didn't get on very well with me. Or to be exact, I didn't get on very well with your mother. I had to go away." We both look over to the pool, where Olaf has actually got one of the ducks round the neck. "I left, and I haven't made contact, before now." She abruptly changes the topic of conversation. "Let's sunbathe." At her insistence, we both strip down to our underwear and lie, our arms innocently around each other, gazing up into the endless blue East Anglian sky, scuffed and smeared with moving clouds. She turns onto her side and stares into my eyes, which I see reflected in her sunglasses, cornflower blue, flecked with emerald green. I cannot describe what happened next without degrading it and cheapening it, without reducing it to banality and coarseness, without breaking the butterfly of spiritual initiation on the wheel of crude exactitude. But anyway, we shagged a couple of times, once in the Ford Anglia stationary, and once when it was careering around the pond at 30 miles an hour, the two of us grunting and squealing with animal pleasure as Olaf busied himself with the ducks. I fell asleep that evening as Susan drove me home, secure in the knowledge that she was not my sister. Olaf snored robustly in the back seat, and the curious odour that emanated from him gave a piquant air to the family dinner that I enjoyed that evening, duck à l'orange. As I lifted my knife to assay a portion of breast, it seemed to me that the texture of duck flesh and the aromatic promise of fruit were redolent of the rough and negligent caress which plundered the orchard of my young manhood that humid summer, the swooning assent to a deliquescent pleasure which yet contained a terrible disclosure, at once a warning and a promise, the hidden meaning of Susan's love for me, which was soon to be revealed.
For One Horrible Moment was written and narrated by Peter Bradshaw. The producer was John Naismith.